Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill, I am.
Yes, and two exciting topics today, a garden of art, Bob, and, you know, my passion these days is transforming my little back garden patch into a potager, into the most beautiful kitchen garden in the whole world.
Potager is French for...
kitchen garden.
I knew that.
You will learn. Stick with me, baby, because you're going to learn all about it from a real expert. In the second part of the show, I have a conversation with Jennifer Bartley. She is the author of Designing the New Kitchen Garden, and she talks about what kind of the difference between a French potager or potager garden is versus an American-style garden and all the kind of different nuances, and then how to go about designing a really cool potager kitchen garden.
One's in francs and one's in dollars.
Exactly. Well, now it's the euro.
That's right.
That's right.
And that's my start.
Back to Pyramid Hill.
Yeah, great place. A man named Harry Wilkes. He was a lawyer, businessman, real estate developer, and he just created this 260-70-acre sculpture garden on top of a
right
hill.
Right up your alley, huh?
Yeah, on top of a hill in Ohio with a little more money than Uncle Bob had. But neat because it's got a house that's kind of subterranean with a big pyramid on top, hence the Pyramid Hill.
I gotcha.
Interesting guy, fun to talk to, and he just did his thing.
Did his thing, yeah, followed his dream. And our producer, Brad Yost, recently visited Pyramid Hill, so we'll have an interactive sort of photo spread of the mighty sculpture. And that's the cool thing about Pyramid Hill is that it's not just like a sculpture garden of little things here and there. This is huge types of sculptures. Super
Brad,
cool.
Brad also came back riding a camel from Pyramid Hill. I'm not sure what that means.
I'm not sure either.
But we're going to go with it. It's a long trip from Cincinnati on a camel.
And you can see it. You can see it.
All right. On a camel.
So that's coming up today on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stay with us. Bob Hill.
Yes, ma'am.
You should be so mighty proud of yourself.
Well, I am mostly, but
mostly
specify.
I did not have the chance to visit Hidden Hill last year.
But we
thank you for having us for brunch the other day.
Yes, ma'am.
You are amazing. It is great out there. It's so amazing how much can really happen in a matter of a couple of years. Things look fabulous.
Thank you.
And I'm so extremely envious. Speaking of the potager, everybody's heard him talk about his 90-foot arbor. He's getting a 90-foot arbor done.
Now you've seen it.
It's so cool.
Thank you.
I love it. And that's what I want. I want your 90-foot arbor style. That's what I want as my enclosure, as my fence around my potager.
We can help you.
So you can help me make that happen. It is awesome.
Well, thank you.
I just loved it.
We're excited, too. And it isn't just me, believe me. My wife and I guess five or six people that have worked there for 4 or 5 years.
Well, I knew it wasn't just you.
Yeah, but it's so much fun to have something in your mind for years and have it come together.
Yeah. And you're making it happen. It's really cool.
Yeah, we're excited.
I was delighted.
Too. Thank you.
So, okay, my fence. What's happening in the garden, right? So my fence is something that I will probably try to chip away at this winter, right? Baby steps, because we don't have as much money as Pyramid Hill does either, or as much money as you.
I don't think so.
So, it's a trickle down sort of thing.
Right.
First sign of deer nibbling in the garden this morning.
Oh dear.
They nibbled some of my green beans, my Emirate pole beans.
At least they have good taste.
That's right. But nothing else was touched, so I'm okay. But that's why I so want your super cool fence.
You'll have it.
Speaking of other nibblings, it is just a fact of nature. When you have a garden, whether it's vegetable, perennial, or otherwise, you're going to have a little nibbling. And the birds have actually finally settled down into enjoying the berry patch.
It's Capistrano.
The blackberries have come on, and it brings them, from all around. So I tie mylar, the red and silver.
Yeah.
I tie mylar to the blackberries and then some of the blueberry bushes. And then we have enough of that tubing and netting that we can net some of the blueberry bushes. So it's all been netted at this point, just to sort of stave the birds from... I mean, literally, they pick you clean.
Is it working?
It's working, yes, it does. Yeah. It does.
You have a three-shot goal and a two-shot goal out there?
It's like it's exactly the same scenario every year. That first part of the season,
they
don't bother it too much, and then bam, all of a sudden... Everybody and their mother knows to come and enjoy the berries.
You're a bird masochist.
Yeah, I know,
you just enjoy getting pecked to death by Hitchcock.
I don't mind sharing a little bit, but, yeah, you know, there you have it. So what's going on in your garden, Bob?
I need your help on this because I can never remember the cultivars or the names, but I have gone, as you've liked salvia for years.
Right.
The black and blue, mm-hmm, is a
Garinatica, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
I sometimes get that messed
and
up,
I just picked up some red and white ones, but they're soft and they're kind, mm-hmm, of fluffy and they're just so
like punchy. The clary sage, maybe.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Part of summer and late summer.
Uh-huh.
And I want 4,000 or 5,000, yeah, of those salvias out there just for a nice little patch because they're gentle colors. They don't, mm-hmm, assault you. It's just indescribable.
Mm-hmm. And they're reliable.
Right.
And they're easy, and they don't mind the heat, and they don't, right, mind if it's dry, and they don't mind if it rains normal, and yeah.
Yeah, so get out there and get some different salvias, mm-hmm, folks, because there's so many nice ones besides the usual run-of-the-mill ones,
right,
that you see.
Different being the operative word, because they look completely different from each other, the different species that are available out there, yeah,
yep,
for sure.
And speaking of old and neat places, mm-hmm, and wide open spaces, we're going to have a man with us here pretty quick who converted basically a barren hill, mm-hmm, near Cincinnati, Ohio, near Hamilton, Ohio, actually, into this 265-acre sculpture garden. It's a great story. His name is Harry Wilkes, and he began with plans for an underground home on this overgrown hill near Hamilton, ended up with a 265-acre sculpture park featuring 65 pieces of art from all over the world and some really great artists. Here to explain how he did that is Harry Wilkes. Harry, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's begin at the beginning on this thing. From the stories I read, back in the early 1980s, you were going to build a house on a 40-acre property near the Miami River?
That's correct.
And tell us about that and how that evolved into this wonderful sculpture park and museum.
Okay, well, it's quite a long story, but I'll try to shorten it up for
okay.
you. But I think it was around 1987, I purchased 40 acres right outside of Hamilton, Ohio, and it was pretty scrubby land. It was it wasn't being used for anything. It wasn't farmland. It wasn't flat. It was going up from the highway in a hilly terrain. And I just started out building a road up from the roadway. Of course, what I did the first day after I started, I purchased this chainsaw. and as time went on, I mean, I hired some fellows, and we bought machetes for them. And we just went through there and just hacked down the vines. And there was poison ivy vines that I never saw vines grow that thick.
Wow.
And there was wild grape all up into the trees, honeysuckle galore. Mm-hmm. I mean, you couldn't see through it hardly. So then eventually I hired a bulldozer to make a road to the top of the hill where I thought I was going to build my home, because I had hiked through there, and it was a very dangerous hike, by the way. I frequently felt I better not, you know, fall down or twist an ankle, because I don't think they'd ever find me. It was so thick. But anyway, we finally made it to the top of the hill. Then I built a lake up there. And then I built a little gazebo on the lake, so that after I got done working at night, hacking down brush and everything, I'd go over there and sit down in my little gazebo with my dog. And I got the idea, and I don't know how I got it, but I got the idea of, why can't I go in one side of that ridge and come out the other side, which, you know, I knew that, it went up the hill. In other words, the ridge went up, and mm-hmm. then it went down. And I thought, well, I know what both sides look like now that I cleared them. So I got the idea of going right through and building an underground home.
So the house is underground, but you still have views on either side?
Absolutely.
All right.
I go in one side, or I go in either side. I got a patio on each side. I have four bedrooms, one in each corner.
Uh-huh.
The hike through the ridge is about 140 feet long,
mm-hmm.
and then the house is 50 feet wide. So you have an idea that you're close to 7,000 square feet inside the house.
Wow.
And
so are there conservation advantages since you're in the ground?
There are conservation advantages, but to be frank with you, I never thought of that,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, I didn't know enough about, you know, solar heat and all that sort of thing, and I didn't want to take any chances on something that I knew very little about. So,
mm-hmm.
but there's certainly advantages to being underground, because you don't have any sidewalls at all.
Mm-hmm.
You have a front and the back. And then, of course, on the top, you had this big pyramid. And I needed the pyramid, and it's glass. And it's the glass is three panes thick, so that it's when you've got all those hermetically sealed pieces of, you know, sheets of glass making your pyramid, you have a very strong pyramid that you can actually, a small man, you know, a lightweight man, can climb up the warship.
Well, Harry,
if he has suction cups and everything,
exactly.
he can go up and actually wash the pyramid.
Had you been collecting art prior to building the house, or did that come with the house?
No, that came later.
Okay, tell us about that.
I had no idea of having any kind of park up there. I was interested in having a place. I was retired, and I wanted a place out in the country, and I thought about building a house out there. Never thought of an underground home either. Mm-hmm. I only thought about the underground when I saw that ridge. Mm-hmm. And then after I built the home, I went ahead and invited people up there because I was starting to build my own golf course, not a commercial course, but one for my private use. And I had my tennis court at that time. I had seven lakes that I had built, and I had fish in the lakes. I had hiking trails.
Wow.
I had, you know, some roadways already up there, blacktop, to get up there. And then as I went on, I bought more than 40 acres. I kept adding and adding on, so I have about 260 acres at this time. Mm-hmm. And although it's not mine now, but anyway, at that time I kept adding on and kept expanding, and then I kept thinking of new things to do, like building my own golf course. As I cleared the land, I thought, well, I must clear this out and put a fairway in, you know?
Well, Harry, where did the sculpture come from then?
Well, okay, here's what happened. Sat down one night and I thought, what if I died? My daughters would have to sell this land. And I didn't, so I thought, well, how do I get out of this? How do I protect this land forever? And I thought, well, the way to do it is to make a foundation. And I didn't want a private foundation, I'll make a public foundation. And then I thought, I don't want baseball diamonds and I don't want soccer fields for the public. What I want is to bring out the sculptures that's in front of skyscrapers in Cincinnati and Chicago and New York and other cities, and put these big sculptures in the country where they belong. And I thought, oh, I'll have a sculpture, not a park, I mean, not a garden, but a sculpture park, a big area. And I thought, well, I never heard of a sculpture park. I heard of a lot of sculpture gardens, but not a park. So a lady from the Cincinnati Enquirer came out from the arts section, and she said, and I told her what I was going to do, and she just went bananas. She said, oh, my goodness, this is perfect. You'll have the best, and there's only a couple. And I said, I didn't know there was any. She says, there's one in New York, and there's one in St. Louis, but she said, and there's another one in North Carolina, but that's it. But if you do it, she says, yours will be the best, because she said, this really got me. It hooked me. She said, your land has natural galleries. And I thought, I don't know what that means, but it's your
sound. Sounds good.
Well, so she told me to go to New York, and then I to see this one park, which I did. And I started to contact some artists, and I started to put it in. I made a foundation, a public foundation, and I appointed people to serve for nothing, free of charge, on the board with me. And I got people interested in it. And so then I... when I made the foundation, I donated the land to the public.
So, Harry, when you spoke to the artists and started amassing the collection, were all of these pieces commissioned, so to speak, especially for the park, or did you acquire other pieces from different places?
Okay, some of both. Mm-hmm. I did commission a couple pieces made especially for the park, and others were made already were in the artist's, in big tracts of land where they set them out. And I got a hold of them and got those, you know, and started to put them in the park.
Do you have a criteria that you use when you choose pieces for the park?
No.
And does the board decide, or do you get to decide?
I decide mostly because the board is made up of people who involve walks of life. There's housewives, there's businessmen, there's university, you know. I mean, all kinds of people are on the board. But
ultimately, you make the decision usually with the pieces.
I made the decision, yeah.
What kind do you like best? Do you have a preference?
Well, the best I can get for the lowest possible price. But it's amazing. I did buy, and I want you to know, I mean, these things, you know, most of which are in the place are not cheap.
Right.
I purchased three from a well-known artist who was living at the time for $333,000, three pieces of his. One of which, now, the one that I really wanted, the big piece, which is called Abracadabra, we have been offered way over $1 million for that, just that one piece now.
Wow.
So, I mean, you see, you know, that artist had died in the meantime, and his work mm-hmm. has gone up in value terrifically. There's other artists now from all over the world who want to get in Pyramid Hill. Mm-hmm. They want to learn how to get their sculpture in. Some we loan, and we actually borrow for a period of time, and then we take an option if we like it. Some pieces are donated by various people. Some are donated by the artist, in mm-hmm. fact.
How many pieces do you have right now?
Well, right now we have close to 60.
Mm-hmm.
And they're scattered throughout the acreage. We're the only museum in the world where you can see, I mean, an outdoor museum, where there's very few of them to begin with. You know, there's only about four, maybe five now in this country, and maybe six or seven in the rest of the world, in Asia and in Europe. So there's, you know, just a little over a dozen parks, sculpture parks. That means at least 50 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they're a garden.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's very few of them, and we now are known all over the world by different artists because they pay particular attention to those artists who are building big work, mm-hmm. you know.
So are they mostly contemporary?
Most of them are contemporary, but mm-hmm. we do have figurative sculptures here, too. We have Eve, and we have Adam,
mm-hmm.
Several others that are figurative. You
right,
know, you can
sure.
actually tell it's a person or it's,
a
you know.
Well, how big are some of these? What's the biggest and maybe the smallest?
One of them is 31 feet high. That's over three stories. Some of them you can spot from an airplane coming into Greater Cincinnati Airport. Some of them you can't. Some of them are small. So they go roughly 6 feet to 30 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them you can just walk under. We're the only park museum in the world where you can rent an art cart that's really a golf cart that's painted Picasso, you know. Or,
oh, and you can tootle around in the art cart.
Right, and they can then go
great.
Right up. In fact, they can drive right under some of the sculpture.
That's a good idea because it makes it more accessible to certain people that might not be able to get around on
right.
their own.
Right, although we have miles of blacktop road, mm-hmm. You can see 90% of it from your own car.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have parking places all over, so you can get out of your car and
okay.
walk up.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have the art cart. And then you can just drive right up to the sculpture and see each one and walk around it, and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we're the only museum in the world like that.
Do you use the art carts when you actually go play golf on your golf course?
Well, we don't have the golf course anymore.
Oh, no,
we're not.
No more golf
We're
course.
Not into that sort of thing anymore.
All
we're
right.
into art.
Just art.
Yeah, the tennis court now is being used for educational purposes.
All right.
In fact, some of the tee-offs are places where, you know, where it was mounted, you know, like
uh-huh.
a tee-off.
Yeah.
There's pieces of sculpture sitting on them.
Perfect platform, huh?
We have the amphitheater that's over one of the greens. We built it right on top of the green because it happened to have a nice downhill slope.
Now, do you envision another 60 pieces, or is there a limit to what you can...
Oh, absolutely.
more.
We'll be here for hundreds of years.
Great.
So you've got an endowment to work with, then.
And we'll have sculpture after sculpture. We're constantly building new places, but they're not right on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are... You go around a bend, or you're on a hiking trail, and you go around a bend, and there's a piece of sculpture staring at you.
Yeah. A nice surprise around
That's
the corner.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, so you can drive around, walk around, although if you hiked, God, it would take you forever. Although we have three hiking trails mm-hmm. for hikers, but you can just hike any place in the park.
So, Harry, what's your favorite piece at this point? I'm sure it changes.
Oh, probably Abracadabra.
Okay.
It is located on a high hill.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it from all over. You can see it from airplanes.
Can you describe it?
We'll just have to come and visit.
When you visit it, you have to walk around it because the different shadows
mm-hmm.
and the different times of the day and all the sculpture you should see from 360 degrees. because you never know what's on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Well, Harry, thanks a lot. It's just been enchanting. And we
look forward to visiting the park and museum for sure.
Oh, well, great, great. I think when people get here, they are amazed that anything like this is around.
Indeed. Thank you, Harry.
Okay, and thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Wilkes converted the 265-acre wooded area around his underground home into the Pyramid Hill Sculpture Park and Museum. If you'd like more information about Harry Wilkes or Pyramid Hill, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, designing a kitchen garden for functionality and beauty, the new American potager. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy. Beauty and productivity and being a part of a larger landscape scheme, well, that's what the potager does, the potager garden or the kitchen garden. And fortunately for me, because this is something that we're working on out at the farm, still in the very baby stages of developing our potager, but good news for me, designing the new kitchen garden, American Potager Handbook, has recently been published by Timber Press. And joining me on the line is Jennifer Bartley. She is a garden designer, author, and photographer with a degree in landscape architecture from Ohio State University. And this is her first book, Designing the New Kitchen Garden, which illustrates her talents in design and her knowledge of the great kitchen gardens of the world, past and present. Jennifer, welcome to Homegrown, and I'm looking forward to learning how to create a beautiful potager garden out at the farm. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Sure. Clearly, I'm excited about this interview. And one of the things that I really liked about the book, other than just sort of the instructional nature of it, once you get into it, but is the history part of it. So let's start there with the tradition of the potager garden. And what exactly is a potager garden?
Okay. Well, a potager really comes from the French, mm-hmm. and it is a French word for kitchen garden. But it's more than a kitchen garden. It's really a philosophy of living connected to the garden and connected to the seasons.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why it appeals to me so much, because I really kind of connect on that level as well. So let's kind of lay out the difference between the basic sort of kitchen garden that we think of in the United States versus the potager, as you say, versus just the farm garden of summer vegetables that many of us around here are most familiar with. Just, you know, everything kind of lined out in rows. You know, what's the difference?
Well, the potager really literally means for the soup pot. That is the French translation of that. And it dates to medieval times, to really the very first gardens. And you can think of even monastery gardens is mm-hmm. one heritage of the potager in France. And so it was an enclosed garden where the monks grew their vegetables and flowers and herbs, and they laid it out in a beautiful way, actually. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, and what was the purpose of that? Do you know what I mean? This notion of beauty, bounty, you know, the harvest, the functionality of it all. But why go to the extreme to make it beautiful?
Well, I think almost that could be a French notion.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in the chateau gardens, when they developed the kitchen garden, even the raised beds, they had an idea of looking from the chateau. So they would look on the garden. So mm-hmm. it was almost a piece of artwork that
okay.
they would look at.
Certainly.
And yet it was also almost a sculpture, because when you're in the garden, then you're in a spatial place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the historic gardens kind of set the standard of design and functionality then, I guess. You speak of the monastic gardens and the French potager. One of the examples that you use in the book is the garden at Versailles. But what struck me most about the images of the potager there is that it almost looked more functional than anything else, where the monastic gardens were more creative. They were more beautiful somehow. Was it just because Versailles was so large that they had to also make sure that there was more of a functionality than a beauty to it?
Yes, I think so. Versailles, of course, the garden of Louis XIV, is a little distance from the Versailles landscape garden. This was the potager of the king, the garden of the king. So it's a 22-acre garden dating to, I believe, the 1600s.
Wow.
And certainly a variety, and even today, as the garden is used today, hundreds and hundreds of varieties of fruits and vegetables and flowers. So it's wonderful.
So is that one of the things, I guess, that differs from, I guess, the traditional American garden and perhaps American kitchen garden, is that you had more of a variety in it?
Yes, I think so. And again, the idea of the seasonal living.
Uh-huh.
I think historically in our kitchen gardens, we would plant maybe in rows, kind of like the farm fields around us,
mm-hmm.
and plant with the idea of putting up, you know, for the summer, or storing or canning.
Right.
And really the notion of the potager is, as I said, to live more connected, so that in the spring you're picking the peas and you're eating fresh right from the mm-hmm. garden, and you may be picking peonies for the table. And then later you'll transition to the summer with the basils and the tomatoes. And so that becomes your menu.
Mm-hmm.
It sets the food palette.
Mm-hmm. So even a 12-season garden in terms of perhaps food, but other things too. I mean, are we talking, you know, when we talk about this notion of bounty and of harvest, it's not always just about nourishment, but also about beauty, you know, picking flowers for the table perhaps, but the medicinal component, which seems to me would have been a very strong part of the monastic gardens, you know, known to be responsible for easing the sufferings of the people. So wouldn't that be largely medicinal and herbal?
Absolutely. And I really like the idea of the monastery garden as kind of a model, mm-hmm. really, for my garden, in mm-hmm. a sense, because the monastery gardens were beautiful, they were enclosed, they were a refuge. So you had the monks who would live there, and yet it did become kind of the hospital of the time,
mm-hmm.
where they would welcome strangers, and certainly it became the hospital as they would heal with the medicine. So in some kind of strange way, I like that idea for my home,
mm-hmm.
to create this paradise, which the monastery gardens had a lot of symbolism, and in fact the kitchen garden, the layout, ideas of paradise. And so I want my home to be a paradise, and
mm-hmm.
I want it to be a refuge and a healing place.
Mm-hmm. And often, and you speak of this too, historically, from different cultural perspectives as well, Western, Eastern, Middle Eastern, that these gardens were places of refuge. They were often walled, so there was a sense of kind of protectiveness and all of that. So that translates into this new kitchen garden and American potager kind of concept for us to look beyond the vegetable garden or the kitchen garden to this philosophy that you talk about, I suppose. That's exactly what it is.
Yes.
Okay.
And so when I say the American potager, I'm saying, yes, this is a new thing for where we live.
Mm-hmm.
And take our suburban or urban residences, our homes, and create a paradise,
mm-hmm.
which I believe
that we can eat
edible plants,
right.
You know, edible flowers.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so in terms of designing a potager, an American potager, what should we consider as the bones of the garden as we first lay it out? And to be honest with you, I come from an extremely selfish perspective on this, because this is kind of the phase that my husband and I are at with our garden out at the farm, that we will, you know, work towards, you know, creating something that's as beautiful as what you show in the book, although we realize it'll take us, you know, a couple of years because we're doing most of it by hand at this point. But what are the bones to begin with?
Well, I think placement of the garden, and that really depends on your site. If you have acres, as you may have, then you might consider, how do you get to the garden? What is the pathway to the garden? Which I believe, and I show in as one example, the garden at North Hill. The pathway to the kitchen garden is really part of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
If you live on a smaller suburban site, consider the placement relating to the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So ideally, the kitchen garden should be near the kitchen,
right.
So that it's convenient for the chef to run out the door and pick the parsley or the basil.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about technicalities like sunlight.
Right.
Really, ideally, to grow vegetables and herbs and flowers, we need about 6 hours of full sunlight.
Okay, so what about the creative sort of considerations? Because one of the, I guess one of the things that appeals to me so much about the potager is the beauty part of it. I want my garden to be beautiful. So how do we make it creatively beautiful and interesting?
Well, I think that there are a couple of ways. An important design feature, as I have already mentioned, is the idea of enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be done in many ways. I talk about edible shrubs, edible roses. These can contribute to this idea of being enclosed.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a fence with vines climbing on it, or it could be a wall, a stone wall,
mm-hmm.
as they had in France. But we may not legally be able to build a 12-foot stone wall on
right.
our property.
Or have the money.
So there are other ways to create this idea of feeling set apart,
okay.
which I call enclosure.
Uh-huh.
So that's number one. Other ways to do it, think about pavement that you use for the walkways. A 3-foot length is a good width for a sidewalk. That way you have room for 2 people possibly to walk.
Mm-hmm.
You have room for a wheelbarrow. And thinking about the pavements and the types of pavements that you use, that would affect the whole visual feature of the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Creating raised beds with stone or wood or brick, this adds another detail to the garden.
Mm-hmm. The concept of, I guess, hardscaping and like architectural features
yes.
also appeals to me, and I think that that's part of what you're bringing up right now in terms of, you know, whether it's a living enclosure or a hardscape sort of enclosure, pathways, that sort of thing. But I also like a couple of folks that have been out to the garden recently have sort of laughed at, which I've taken some offense to.
Oh.
They've sort of laughed at my bamboo teepees and stuff that I've constructed and my little twig teepees, you know, to put over things so that they'll have something to climb on and all that. And it's just
right.
because the teepee poles are real. I mean, it's really the bamboo is really, really tall.
Right.
But I think it's like super cool, right?
Absolutely.
So architecturally, what are some of the different things that we can create that will, you know, add some interest to the garden visually, but also, you know, prove to have some sort of function in terms of our plants?
Right. What you say is exactly true. When we think of a kitchen garden, often many of the plants are very low. They're on the same plane, which can be interesting when you look down upon that view, almost like a painting. But we do need to add some verticality into the garden. And an easy way to do this is with some vertical structures. Yes, and they provide a place for the peas to climb, for the beans to climb, a number of flowers to climb. I use, and in the book I show some pictures, the bamboo poles that I have, I've painted a bright blue. Which
yeah,
is
I saw those. It
the
looks
color
great.
Of my dining room. So
uh-huh.
there's this connection because I'm looking from my house, from my dining room, out directly into my garden. So
uh-huh.
the color I've continued out into the garden.
Cool. Great. Arrangements of flowers and vegetables, you know, the whole notion of the perennial, the annual, this whole season of something interesting. The potager is a garden that you can visit in the wintertime and you'll be able to find something of interest or something going on because it's not just an annual vegetable patch, but also herbs and other types of flowers. Is there something that is sort of the general rule of thumb in terms of combining all these different things?
Well, I think some helpful rules would be use some boxwood is a nice structural plant.
Mm-hmm.
It, if we could use it for an edge or a boundary or in the garden, it provides evergreen color throughout the season. And when we talk about kitchen gardens, we're talking about a useful garden. But I consider the visual of the garden to be mm-hmm. a use of the garden.
Yeah.
So when I look out the window
enjoy
in the winter and I see a beautiful structure or
mm-hmm.
I see a sculptural element of the teepees left over, or my lavender, for example, which turns to a nice gray in the winter, that's a use of the garden because
right.
I'm getting a satisfactory visual use of the garden.
Mm-hmm.
So in my potager, I have the fence, and then right outside the fence, I have a collection of perennials, mainly perennials, although I do have some rhubarb. Yeah. Well, rhubarb is a perennial, so but other annuals tucked in there. But mm-hmm. mainly the idea of that, and I leave this bed alone. I'm not tilling this bed. It stays from year to year. Mm-hmm. But these flowers are attracting the beneficial insects. Now, inside my garden, I have found that I like to leave a space for the annuals. So I have four raised beds, and I will say that I do have a slight border of lavender that I leave in place. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it can be a clean slate every year.
Right.
I can use annual flowers and annual vegetables mixed in together.
Okay.
But I'm not, when you till and prepare the soil and add compost, you're not disturbing the perennial plants. So I've found okay. that works very effectively.
It's more, I suppose, efficient to have your annuals all in their same bed and your perennials all in their own other bed.
I have found that yeah. works most conveniently.
It actually makes a lot of sense. I'm glad you pointed it out because I had some notions of maybe mixing things a little bit. One of the things too, Jennifer, for people like you and me, we like doing this sort of thing. I don't mind the maintenance part of it, but a lot of people are, a little consternated by weeds and other maintenance issues that the garden sometimes poses. Are there tricks in your mind that help facilitate the whole maintenance of a large kitchen garden?
Well, you are right. It's not necessarily a low maintenance idea,
mm-hmm.
and I love to putter around in the garden,
yeah, so
it works for me.
It works for
it's
me, too.
It's fun. I would say that planting, and this is where annual flowers can help you out. You can plant more flowers. Perhaps you know of a season that you're going to be busy for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do less vegetables and a little more flowers for that season.
Okay.
That way it's still beautiful, but you're not having to be in there maintaining mm-hmm. the vegetables as
mm-hmm.
much.
Mm-hmm. Watering, that sort of thing. I know that historically a lot of the gardens were designed with the central water source. Is that something that you still recommend in terms of design or just, work with what you have? Because I think that's a kind of a nice concept, but also a very practical one.
Yes, and certainly really from a design standpoint, to have a little water feature can be very nice.
Mm-hmm.
I find for my own garden, I like this idea. We have this idea of slow cooking, the slow eating idea. I like mm-hmm. the idea of slow gardening,
mm-hmm.
and I say that because I water my little garden by hand.
Yeah.
And I like that because as I'm watering, I'm kind of viewing each vegetable, each plant, keeping an eye on it, and sometimes the lavender needs less water than the vegetable, so
right.
each plant gets its specific need.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You bring up this whole notion of like slow gardening, which I like, in relationship to the slow food movement. People really enjoying the seasonal cooking. So I'd kind of like to discuss with you a little bit this notion of eating fresh food. I think for me, I know, like my niece, for example, she's 6 years old, and they love coming over and picking blueberries and that sort of thing. But it's only this time of the year that she will eat salad because she knows she can harvest it from her mom's garden.
Wow.
But, other times of the year, we can never get her to eat salad. But this every year lately, this is the time of the year Teal says, oh, Georgiana's eating salad again.
Wow.
So that's, I think, one reason why we should all garden, because it teaches kids a stronger connection with food. But what I've noticed is definitely I crave foods that are in season. And I also crave a more pure cooking style.
Yeah.
When I can harvest it from my garden.
Yeah.
So it's, olive oil and herbs and that sort of thing. But, more pure sort of simple taste, probably because the vegetables and the greens and everything else just tastes so much better than what you can purchase at the grocery store.
Absolutely.
Do you see that people are connecting more and more with this notion of slow gardening, as you say, because they do value sort of this seasonal experience, this taste experience, this food experience?
Yes, I see a couple of things happening. the garden really is the new hearth of the home. So instead of standing around inside the kitchen, we're now standing outside in the garden, I find, in my house. When people come over, we immediately go out to the garden. Mm-hmm. We want to entertain, we want to live, we want to eat, we want to play, all in the garden. Mm-hmm. So the idea of enjoying the garden is one aspect. And then the other aspect is, as you say, this seasonal cooking and being able to just pick from the garden. Really, it's the ultimate fast food.
Yeah,
it's faster than getting in the car and going to the fast food restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, and it tastes tons better. Jennifer, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed the book, and I've learned lots, and I'll be using it as I create my own potager here in Shelby County, Kentucky. Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
Jennifer Bartley is the author of Designing the New Kitchen Garden, an American Potager Handbook. It's published by Timber Press. She lives in Granville, Ohio, where she gardens and designs great gardens that offer beauty and bounty. If you'd like more information on designing the new kitchen garden, please visit our website at wfpl.org. Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Robert Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we got questions.
We do have questions.
We've had potagers, we've had pyramids.
We have, and now,
now we've got
questions.
Some possible questions we can answer.
All right, shall I start?
Go ahead.
This one is from Linda in Frankfurt. She says, I have to dig a holly tree, a small one, about 3 feet tall. I'll be putting it in my yard. Where would it like to live? Out in the open or close to the house? Do they like full sun or half and half? Should I fertilize when I plant? Some very good basic questions in terms of what's going to make her American holly tree happy. What do you think, Bob?
I think right now is a fine time to do it, early in the spring or later in the fall, actually. I think I'd prefer it away from the house where I could see it from the window.
You know, they can get, if it is an American holly, they can get very big.
40, 50 feet tall. Yeah. And a lot of times you see them scrunched against the house because they were planted there too many years years ago. And so out there in the yard, the other thing is you need a male pollinator. I hope she's got one.
It's a female,
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Because we didn't get the sex of it.
Right.
Well, we didn't get the nitty gritty
details.
We don't
do that kind of thing. But if it's a girl and you want berries, you're going to have a guy somewhere around there to...
I think, what do they say, like a mile radius? So if somebody in the neighborhood has a male that pollinates, you'll be okay, but usually like a mile radius.
They're great trees. They take a little patience and a little work sometimes to get them, but once they're cranked
up. And full sun's, I think, probably ideal if you want a fuller sort of growth habit, but they do tolerate some shade, to be sure, so it's not that you have to have them in full sun. Fertilization, I wouldn't recommend any sort of granular fertilizer, nor would I recommend any amendment to the soil. The school of thought now is to give it what it's going to have, you know, permanently. So just dig a nice big hole for it to loosen the soil. If you want, you can water it in with a little water-soluble fertilizer, you know, like Watch Us Grow or something like that. But yeah, no major fertilization is needed by any means.
Just,
I'm sorry. The probably the number one warning I would give is make sure that you keep it well watered, particularly if we go into some dry periods where Mother Nature doesn't offer any rain. Because being a broadleaf evergreen like that, they can dry out a little more quickly than you might think. And the symptoms don't show for a while until it's too late, right?
Those darn leaves fall off.
Yeah.
If you want to see what you're getting into, go down to Bernheim, check out their holly collection.
It's
one of the best in the country, and you'll see what you're going to have in another 20 or 30 years.
Okay, Bob, this is from Fred. Hi, Bob and Janine. I really enjoy your show. I have a question. My wife is from Europe and really wants to plant a European linden. The European linden is Tilia cordata. Where she's from, they use the blossoms as a tea. They smell beautiful, but even taste better. Wondering if that's a good plant for this area.
Indeed, I've got one growing in my yard even as we speak. I got it from a nursery in Tennessee. She's right in the fact they're probably not readily available in most nurseries,
but they're there.
Look around or go online, plug it in, and just plug in Tennessee nursery or Kentucky nursery, They're both of them are online now, yeah. And you'll I think you'll find one reasonably close.
Yeah, you should. Because a lot of the small specialty owned nurseries have trees like this.
I love the tree, too.
Yeah, and I think even the University of Kentucky recommends the European Linden, a couple of different cultivars for our area, so you should be
it's
able to find
them. It's a neat little blossom.
I like it. Yeah, it's great. Okay, moving right along. Next question. This one's from Steve Barry. This I don't have much experience with, but you should because you've got all your little fish pond action going on.
Right.
They have a small pond that they dug on their property, about half acre. After some moss and weed problems, they got some grass carp, and then they didn't have any problems for at least 8 to 10 years, they said. Last year, they added a waterfall, but now they have a moss and slime problem on the rocks and in the pools of the waterfall, Bob. Is there anything that they can add to the pond that won't hurt their fish or cost an arm and a leg?
I feel their pain. I have exactly the same problem. I put in a new waterfall and thing last year, and it's gorgeous, but in the early winter sunlight, the slime has popped on there for me, too. Now, the scale's different. There are chemicals you can use. You can go to a local pond store or a reliable plant store, read the labels, and many of these additives say they are safe for the fish.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about 500 to 750 gallons. They've got a half acre.
So, and like,
it's a different animal, but there are chemicals that'll do it.
And they're usually, like, you can find them at farm supply stores as well,
yeah.
for, like, farm ponds. And they'll be labeled accordingly. As I said, I don't really know that much about it, but contact County Extension or soil and water conservation people can also help manage some of those.
And the exactly. Soil and conservation, they gave a seminar a couple of years ago on taking care of ponds.
Yeah.
That'd be the first place to go for a pond that size. But there is help available.
Yeah.
Trust me, it'll happen.
Yeah.
Miss Wishy, here's another question for you from, is it Dumbo the elephant? No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding, Elizabeth. It's Elizabeth Burke. It's a good question. It's a sweet question, really. Here's my question. I would like our grandchildren to see peanuts grow. Where can I find a handful of peanut seeds? Signed, Barnum Bailey, Elizabeth Burke.
actually, that is a good question. I was tempted to buy some seed peanuts last winter when I was looking through seed catalogs. I know that Gurney's has seed for peanuts.
Good.
So you can go to gurneys.com or, you know, try to get a Gurney's catalog, some form or fashion. You can buy a seed packet, like a 1 ounce seed packet, $1.65. That's pretty cool. I love peanuts in the shell. So one of these days I'm going to try to grow some peanuts myself.
I'm almost addicted to them.
Yeah. So good luck on that.
Okay. If you have a question or a hungry elephant, go to the homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, I've had people do this to my Coca-Cola back when I was younger.
Yeah, but, or your punch.
Yeah, but the Latin word of the week this week kind of falls into
good.
That punch bowl, so
I
to speak.
I kind of like that connection there. Yeah, the Latin word of the week this week means spiked, if you're wondering.
This is my youth now, folks.
This is pretty straightforward, I think.
Yeah.
Spicata.
Right.
Spicata means spiked. So, for example, Amelanchier spicata, which
spiked service berry.
It doesn't have a common name as such. So, Amelanchier spicata, Corylopsis spicata.
The spiked winter hazel.
Winter hazel, yeah. Corylopsis, kind of like a witch hazel, but a little bit different.
Blooms real early.
Yeah, blooms
I've got
real early.
Believe it or not.
Yep. Veronica spicata, that one's probably pretty well-known to most gardeners. Yeah. Spiked speedwell.
That's fun to say, too.
Yeah.
The spiked speedwell.
Spiked speedwell.
Yeah.
Mintha spicata.
Spearmint. Perfect.
Spearmint. So, like, I had an epiphany when I was doing this.
Yeah.
Spearmint. Spearmint.
Right.
I like, spearmint to me was always just kind of like a flavor, a sensation, a taste.
Right.
But, like, it's mint that has spear-shaped leaves.
And they make bubble gum out of it, or chewing gum.
Exactly.
Sure.
But spearmint, instead of just plain old mint.
Mintha
spicata, because it's spiky. Spiky, spiky, spiky.
Mm-hmm.
Liatris spicata.
The dense gay feather.
Dense gay feather. And I mean, gay feathers
spiky
are spiky kind of to begin with anyway. So if you see a plant that has spicata in its botanical Latin name, you'll know that likely something about that plant is going to be spiked.
Absolutely.
Yep. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Brian Upchurch on contorted and pendulous trees and Ed Gilman on sustaining healthy roots.
Homegrown is produced by Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishey. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.